Listen, we're finishing up the book of Nehemiah, start the book of Esther next week. How long has it been since a man studied the book of Esther? Sometimes ladies, the book of Esther is covered in ladies' class, but how much do we know about the book of Esther? Don't know much at all about it, and we're ready tonight to finish up these last chapters. We'll start in chapter 12 tonight, and so let's look at chapter 12 of the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah chapter 12, and let's just talk about what lessons do we learn. Well, historically, we've got it sort of figured out where Nehemiah fits. Biblically, I hope you have at least in a general sense of what happened to the Jews after Moses died and Joshua led the Jews into the promised land. They're there in the promised land, and they've got to have some sort of government. You can't have a nation without having some kind of government. And so they had the judges. The reality was that God was their judge. You're not really aware of that, was their king. You're not really aware of that until the people ask for a king. And the Lord, and Samuel's all upset. Samuel's greatly upset because they've asked for, to not have judges. He was the last of the judges, and his sons were not fit to be judges, and so they said, let us have a king. And the Lord says to Samuel, and get this, and put it in your head, Samuel, they've not rejected you, they've rejected me that I should be their king. From the time they came out of Egypt, Exodus chapter 19, verse 6, they were a kingdom. They just didn't really understand it. I mean, they should have understood it because the king's the guy that's in charge, and God was in charge. You read the book of, all the books of Moses, and you'd understand God's in charge. And so you got about 350 years of the judges. Then you've got the kings, Saul and David and Solomon. Each of those men reigned 40 years. So you got 350 years plus 120 years. Then you've got the divided kingdom, and if you only follow the southern kingdom, you've got, from 931 B.C. to about 605, is that 300 years of the southern kingdom, 931 to 605? So you've got another 300 years before they head into Babylonian captivity for 70 years, and now they've come back. And they come back in three groups. The first one, the largest one, led by Zerubbabel. A second, led by Ezra, who comes back and helps them restore the worship. And then Nehemiah, and that's the book that we're in. So that's the general overview of the Old Testament. Now, after they get back, you're finished almost with the historical books of the Old Testament. And so you've got the last three books of the Bible who are prophets who live after they come back or during the time of the restoration. Then you got 400 years before Jesus comes when there's no prophet there. And so try to put that in place in your mind in relationship to where we are. The Jews have come back from Babylonian captivity. Now the Lord said over and over again, only a remnant shall return. And so if you begin looking at the book of Nehemiah and you get to chapter 12, look at those first 26 verses. You want to pronounce every one of those names, it's just sort of like reading the genealogies, except these names are not familiar names. Fortunately, in the begats of Matthew chapter 1, there are names there that you do recognize, but these are names you hardly recognize at all. Well, wonder why you have all of these names that are here. And the answer is found whenever you look at the early verses, and the early verses say they're the priest, they're the Levites. Do you understand the place of Levites in the Old Testament system? You could not normally offer a sacrifice on your own. the Lord did talk about it in the book of Deuteronomy that says when you get in the land, you can build an altar out of the earth. And so evidently there were sacrifices that were made by individuals who were not at the tabernacle, who were not at the temple. And so there was some form of sacrifices that were to be made. But when it comes to sin offering and trespass offerings and things of that nature, you couldn't do it. You had to have the priest. And he had to be a priest from the tribe of Levi. You just couldn't do it. It was not acceptable. You remember when Saul offered the wrong sacrifice? He'd only been king for about a year. It was in the second year of his reign. And when Saul took it upon himself, Saul being the king, but of the tribe of Benjamin, God says, "That's it, King Saul. You've lost the kingdom. Your sons are not going to be kings over this land." And so while it is awkward to us to look at these things and see all of these names, you've got to recognize just how important it was to have all of these men there at that time at their place so that sacrifices might be made. And so you look at the first 20 verses, and these are the ones who came back with Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel came back years before Nehemiah was there. And so there were priests that came back, and obviously there were those priests that were there with Zerubbabel and with Ezra. Otherwise, you couldn't restore the worship. But whenever you get to verse 21 through 26, here are the latter priests that come. And they're mentioned specifically, and evidently they are there. And one of those verses talks about this was the list that was kept while they were in captivity. How important is that? You got to have the lineage. You got to have the genealogy. Genealogy was so important to Judaism. The property was kept by genealogy, and so it was always kept tribally within by the genealogies. But the Levites, though they had no land, they were such an important part of it, because they were the ones who were there to offer sacrifices. Now then, whenever you get the list of all of these priests and find all of their names, they're now ready to celebrate the completion of the wall. Are there times of celebrations that we have that are special celebrations, special times of prayer? What about whenever we moved into this building? Was that a pretty good time? I'm not sure that we did this, but at one time we talked about on that Sunday morning, we would all meet in the old building and then we'd come as a caravan over here to this building. I don't think that became a reality. That was, what, 20 years ago. Some of your memories may be better than that. And we came to this building. You remember how thankful we were to be able to have this building? Some of you go back to the building on 36th Street, and you remember what year was that built, Johnny? Was that 64, about 64 that building was built? And Betty's shaking her head yes. She knows what child she was pregnant with at the time, and she's shaking her head real yes right now. But it was about 64 when they moved into that. You remember when you left North Olive? Anybody ever worship on Coniston Road? Jeff, you don't go back to Coniston. I know you were 6 years of old at one time on North Olive, so you remember that. Jeff and Jim, his brother, beat up some kids because they were misbehaving in Bible class. Some such story like that, and the kid wasn't behaving. And I remember the story just learning from Jeff, 35, 36 years ago when I moved down here. Jeff was talking about that little boy was misbehaving in class, and he and Jim just took him out under that sign that was right in front of that building on North Olive, had a real serious talk with him about his behavior in worship. Those are good times, weren't they? And here's one of those times. And it's a time of thanksgiving, and so you get down to these verses.
Now at the dedication of the walls of Jerusalem, they sought out the Levites in their places. Dedication of the walls. The walls have been completed, and we've already read about that in the study of Nehemiah. And now there's the dedication of the walls. The empty lot beside our house is now ready to start construction of a new house on that empty lot that's been there. That thing been covered with all those trees like a jungle and everything. And met my neighbor, and he says, "Well, when I build the house, I want you to come over and bless the house." Well, I'm pretty sure that's a Catholic background kind of thing where that had happened. And I'm going to go over. If you ask me again, I'm going to go over. We're going to have prayer that there will be happiness in this home. Nothing wrong with praying that God would be that. It's not the priest coming in to bless the house in that sense of the word. But I'm glad he feels that would help him. And you've got, there's not a feast of dedication is what I'm trying to say. And yet there are times in our lives that we need to remember some really, really great times. Any of you know the date of the month and the day that you were baptized? You know, I don't know if that's special to you. Jeff said he held up his hands. He remembers that. I have two birthdays. The one that counts in my life is June the 1st. That's when I obeyed the gospel. And June the 1st never comes in the calendar year without me remembering that time at the congregation in West Huntsville, the gospel meeting, who was preaching in the meeting. Don't remember the sermon, but I remember being baptized that night. It's when I became Christian. Those days really, really become important to us. Now, how do they do it? Well, they got all the Levites in their places to bring them to Jerusalem to celebrate the dedication with gladness. I want you to look at all the happiness there is. Gladness, thanksgiving, singing, cymbals, string instruments, and harps. And God wanted, God, Psalm 150 said, that's the way you can worship me. And then there are these singers, the sons of the singers gathered together from the countryside around Jerusalem. And then a list of some of the villages. And verse 29 talks about they came from some fields that were outside these villages. You'd live inside the village. You go out and work in the fields, you know, at the beginning of the day you would go out. That's why Matthew 24 says that, you know, if you're in the field and you see the army coming, don't go back and get your clothing, which has been kept at the end of the fields. You just head on out. You leave there. Don't go back and get your garments. And then it says, then the priest and the Levites purified themselves and purified the people and the gates and the walls. So I brought the leaders of Judah up on the wall, and I got two large thanksgiving choirs. I want you to get a picture of this. They arrive at the right hand. One went to the right hand, and they went toward the refuse gate. If you've got the King James, you probably get a better picture of what this is. Isn't the old King James calls it the dung gate? And so here's a group that heads in that direction. And then there are the other groups, and there are the names of those individuals. And there are the other groups, verse 38, who go in the opposite direction. And I was behind them with half of the people on the wall going past the Tower of the Ovens as far as the Broadway. And then there's the listing of all of these gates. So that the two, verse 40, thanksgiving choirs stood in the house of God. Likewise, I and half of the rulers with me. And so evidently they got there and they marched around the walls of the city. And they arrived at the other side. And what a great day of celebration that was. Because now the walled city gives them protection. A city without walls is vulnerable and it's open. I think it is remarkable in one of the books of the minor prophets, got to be Zechariah, who said to the city before the walls were built, by the way, you do have a wall. The Lord is your wall, and it's a wall of fire that I'm around this city. And so our providence doesn't really, is not protection, doesn't really come from walled cities. I think it's interesting that Satan said about Job, You know, have you considered my servant Job? And what'd Satan say? I can't get to him. Why? You put a hedge around him. We need to understand that in the midst of all of the adversity, that God is around us. And so Thanksgiving is not just for, you know, the fact that we may have some security, and I'm thankful for all the physical security that we have, but we need to understand that the things that are involved in that. Starting in verse 44, he talks about at the same time, there were individuals who were appointed over the rooms of the storehouse for the offerings and the first fruits. If you look at the diagram of the temple, there was the temple itself. There was all those courtyards. The courtyards we're most familiar with are the courtyards that were in the temple in the first century. There's the court of the Gentiles and the court of women. But around every one of those courtyards were rooms. And it's a place where they kept the firewood. It's where they kept certain of the sacrifices that were non-perishable kinds of sacrifices. And so he talks about these rooms that were around this for the first fruits and the tithes, to gather them into them from the fields of the city, the portion specified by the law for the priest and the Levites, for Judah rejoiced over the priest and the Levites who ministered. 45 says, the singers, the gatekeepers, kept charge of their God and the charge of the purification according to the commandment of David and Solomon his son. For in the days of David and Asaph of old, there were chiefs of the singers and songs of praise and thanksgiving to God. I don't know if you've ever read in the book of Psalms, a psalm of David, or to the chief musician Asaph. And so there was this choir that was ongoing, that was there, used for the service of God. Verse 47 says, in the days of Zerubbabel and in the days of Nehemiah, all Israel gave portions for the singers and the gatekeepers. And so here are those individuals who served at the temple, and there were the Levites who were there, they were supported, and here are the singers that are supported. It's possible that the singers themselves came from the tribe of Levi. They also consecrated holy things for the Levites, and the Levites consecrated for them by the children of Israel. On that day, celebration day, they read from the book of Moses in the hearing of the people, and in it they found it written, that's chapter 13, verse 1, found it written that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever come into the assembly of God. Well, what's happened? Well, who are these Ammonites and who are these Moabites? They are the cousins of the Jews. You remember when Lot came out of Sodom, went up into the place where he was going to abide? He had two daughters, and they got Lot drunk, and on consecutive nights, one daughter went in, and on the next night, the other daughter went in and lay with Lot and had children in what we would call an incestuous relationship. And the sons that came out of that event, the first were the Ammonites and the second were the Moabites. So they're cousins. But what had happened is they had come back. And when they came back, they had been received in the fellowship and made a part of Judaism. When they read the Old Testament, guess what they found out? That the Ammonites and the Moabites do not have a portion with those things. Well, why? Well, the latter part of verse 1, that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever come into the assembly, should ever come into that assembly. And then he says, because they had not met the children of Israel with bread and water. I don't know if you're aware of the fact of why they came back to where they had been under the time of Moses. They left Moses. Moses left
led them from Mount Sinai up to the southern border of Israel to a place called Kadesh Barnea. Well, that's when they sent the spies out and said, you cannot come into this land. Well, the spies came back and said, you cannot come into this land. Well, they wandered for 40 years in the wilderness. 40 years later, they returned to Kadesh Barnea. Kadesh Barnea was just on the southern edge of the promised land. This time, instead of going in through the southern area and going immediately up toward what we would know as Jerusalem, it was God's will that they go around the southern edge of the Dead Sea and go eastward over to the east side of Jordan, come up the east side of the Dead Sea, and come up to the east side of Jordan. Guess who was in the way? The Ammonites and the Moabites. And so they asked permission of the Ammonites and the Moabites, let us go through this land. We won't harm anything. If our cattle harm any of the land that's there, we'll reimburse you for it. But the Ammonites and the Moabites said, no, you cannot come this way. And so if you look at that map of the Exodus, they have to go all the way back farther south and to go back down to that other arm of the Red Sea and then come back up on the eastern shore. Well, when they get up there, what do the Moabites do? Instead of welcoming them into the promised land and being allies and being a part of the descendants of Abraham, they hired Balaam against them to curse them. And when Balaam, the false prophet, arrives, instead of cursing them, he blesses them. And when they heard this, they then separated themselves from this mixed multitude that was there. So the first problem they had in those first three verses is the problem they had with the Moabites and the Ammonites. Separated themselves from them. Now, before this, we begin reading about some of the other problems, and there's a man by the name of Eliashib, the priest, who had authority over the storerooms in the house of God. They built a temple. They've got all of this storage area in the walls that surround that temple area. And he had an ally by the name of Tobiah. Recognize that name from earlier reading in this book? Yeah. There's Tobiah. He's that Samaritan, the way we would describe this individual. And guess what had happened? Eliashib had allied with Tobiah, the enemy of God, one who did everything he could from ever getting them to rebuild the walls of the city. And Tobiah, he had prepared for him a large room that previously had stored the grain offerings and the frankincense and the articles and the tithes of the grain and the new wine and the oil, which were commanded to be given to the Levites. But during all of this time, Nehemiah was not there when all of this transpired. For remember when Nehemiah had left Persia, he told the king, this is how long I'm going to be there. He'd gone back to Persia. And in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I returned to the king. And after certain days, I got permission from the king. And I came back to Jerusalem. And guess what I discovered? We've got a Samaritan. We've got somebody that's been trying to destroy Judaism and never let it happen. And he's rented a room. He's right in the temple itself. Not the holy place, not the most holy place. But Eliashib had rented out this room or had made provision for Tobiah to come into this room. And when I discovered the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah in preparing the room for him in the court of the house of God, it grieved me bitterly. You want to talk about righteous indignation? I threw out all of the household goods of Tobiah in the room that he had. It's not just that Jesus cleansed the temple twice in his life. Here is Nehemiah. And he uh,
Nehemiah has a fire inside of him. It's remarkable. We may not have time to cover everything, but look down in verse 25. When he's dealing with another problem that had developed there, and this also had to do with the Israelites who had married the descendants of Ammon and Moab, the ones we just read about, I contended with them and cursed them, struck some of them, and pulled out their hairs, and made them swear by God, saying, you shall not give your daughters to be married to the Moabites. Sounds like Nehemiah has some very strong feelings about living right and doing right, doesn't it? And so he goes in and he cleanses the temple. In Jesus' day, it was the money changers in the temple. In Nehemiah's day, it was Tobiah and his family. You know what he did? Eliashib said, no, take all of this holy food that's been given to the Levites and get rid of all of this storage of things that are there for the worship of God. And Tobiah, you can come up there and you can live up there in that place. I can't believe it happened. But obviously it did. And he says in verse 8, get back to verse 8. He said, I threw out all the household goods of Tobiah out of that room. I commanded them to cleanse the room. I brought back into them the articles for the house of God. Do righteous people ever have problems? Ever have church problems? That's what this is. Church is not there. But thank God that there are leaders who will stand up and say, it shall not happen. I had an aunt when she was in her 20s. Some of those of you who are in your 30s, perhaps, in your 20s, she and the women out at the Paint Rock Church of Christ, a little small country church just outside of Huntsville, and the men were drinking so much on Saturday night, they would come to church on Sunday and they'd be drunk. What can a woman do in relationship to that? You know what my Aunt Lorraine did? She and some of the other younger women in the church got the locks changed on the church building. And so when those men who'd been coming to church drunk on Sunday, when they arrived, they couldn't open the building. And those women in the church said, you guys have no right to do what you're doing and trying to serve God in the condition that you're in. 25-year-old women in the church dealt with the problem. Thank God. Thank God for Aunt Lorraine for what she did. And those other young women that were in the church, I learned about it. Aunt Lo was a... Much older, you know. I knew her when in my teen years, but a remarkable person. Thank God there are people who will put their stand down and take a stand for righteousness. And you know of some other stories, too. If you've been in the church long, you've known of some situations where it's not pleasant. It's not a pleasant time. You know what the men did? I don't know if they quit drinking, but they quit drinking on Saturday nights. They quit drinking on Saturday nights in relationship to that. And then he says, I also realized that the portion for the Levites had not been given unto them. The Levites were not farmers. They were to be supported by the tithes of the people, and the tithes are there in this storehouse, and now there's no place to keep the tithes for the Levites. You know what the Levites had to do? It says that each of the Levites and his singers who did the work had gone back to the fields. So I contended with the rulers and said to them, why is the house of God forsaken? I gathered them together and set them in the place, and all Judah brought the tithes of the grain and the new wine and the oil back to the storehouse. And I appointed as treasurers over the storehouses We don't want Eliashib. We want these men who are named in verse 13, for they were considered faithful, and their task was to distribute to them to the brethren. Remember me, O God, concerning this, and do not wipe out the good that I have done. Isn't that amazing? Don't you worry sometimes as you've gotten older about the good that you've done and if it's really accomplished anything? And Nehemiah is older in his life now. He's fought the fight. And then he's praying to God, God, don't let the work that I've done on this earth come to nothing. Remember me, O God, for the work that I've done. Problem number next in verse 15. I saw the people in Jerusalem treading the wine presses on the Sabbath day. They were bringing in donkeys full of grapes and loaded donkeys with wine and grapes and figs of all kinds. And they brought them into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. The men of Tyre, mentioned them in that sermon Sunday morning, Tyrus, city of Tyre. They dwelt in that area also, and they brought in their fish. And I contended, verse 17, I contended with the nobles of Judah and said to them, why do you do this evil thing? Did not your fathers do this, and did not our God bring all this disaster on us? And you know why we went into Babylonian captivity? Because we did not keep the Sabbath day. So it was that at the gates of Jerusalem, as it began to be dark before the Sabbath, I commanded the gates to be shut and not to be open until the Sabbath was completed. Friday night, close the gates. There will be no trading on the Sabbath day. I posted some of my servants at the gates so that no burdens would be brought in on the Sabbath day. Now the merchants and the sellers of all kinds of wares lodged outside Jerusalem once or twice, but they couldn't get in. And I warned them, why do you spend the night around the walls? If you do it again, I will lay hands on you. And so the gates were locked on the Sabbath day. That ought to help you understand Matthew 24 about the destruction of Jerusalem. Pray that your flight be not on the Sabbath day. Why? Gates of the city are locked. It's not that they're trying to observe a Sabbath day's journey. Sometimes people read that in Matthew 24 and think, well, you couldn't travel on the Sabbath day. Look, those Christians are not under that Sabbath day's journey law. And so the Lord says, pray that your flight be not on the Sabbath day. Why? Because the gates of the city are going to be locked and you couldn't get out. And then he said, pray that it be not in the winter time. That's not a holy winter. That's like the holy Sabbath. They were not observing a holy Sabbath because they were concerned about being able to get out of the city. And once again, Jeremiah says, remember me, the latter part of verse 22, O my God, concerning this also, and spare me according to the greatness of your mercy. And then there is that problem that comes with the Ammonites and the Moabites and the marriages between unbelievers and believers. When you got to the end of the book of Ezra, they dealt with the problem in the days of Ezra. So I contended with these individuals and with them and cursed them, because the results of this was, verse 24, since they had married the Ashdods, the people of Ashdod, that's the Philistines, they could not speak the language of Judah, spake according to the language of one or the language of the other people. You cannot have marriages between unbelievers and believers without it greatly impacting the children. And this is exactly what happened. They knew the holy language of God, part of it, but they had brought into those homes the language of Ashdod. I don't guess you guys at Palm Beach Lakes have ever heard a sermon, unless it's way back yonder, about the language of Ashdod. But sometimes those kinds of sermons are preached, and maybe we ought to preach it today. where we take denominational words and bring them over into the church. I'm amazed how often members of the church who are new in the church, or some who've been there some time, will introduce me to their friends and saying, "This is our pastor. This is our pastor." That's the language of Ashdod. I'm not a pastor. I'm an evangelist, I'm a minister, I'm a preacher, but I'm not a pastor. Well, where'd that come from? Well, here's denominational terminology that comes in. When we were designing this building, architects said, well now, how large do you want the sanctuary to be? You know what building he was talking about? Yeah, he's talking about this room right here. Understood what he was trying to say. But sanctuary has to do with holiness. This room in this building is no more holy than the other rooms that's in this building. And yet we develop a concept of this being the holy building, the holy room. And sometimes we'll have visitors. Some denominational person would come to our building during the week and say, "Can I just come into the sanctuary and pray?" And they come into this room to pray. We try to use that as an opportunity to get to know them and to teach them, but there's a denominator, and sometimes people will call this room the sanctuary, as though this room is more holy than some other room. It's really, really holy right now. About 3 minutes from now, it won't be holy anymore. You know why? We're not having Bible study here anymore. But that's sort of sometimes you hear the language of Ashdod. I do not like the terminology, a Church of Christ preacher. Where does that come from? Well, there's a Baptist preacher who preaches the doctrine of the Baptist church. But there's no doctrine of the Church of Christ. There's no such thing as a Church of Christ preacher. There are members of the church who preach, but we don't preach the Church of Christ dogma. That's a misuse of that word. Sometimes we do it when we're in a discussion and somebody in a workplace, "What are you?" And somebody says, "Well, I'm a Methodist." And somebody else says, "Well, I'm a Baptist." And somebody else, they'll say to somebody, "What are you?" "I'm a Church of Christ." No, you're not. The Church of Christ has to do with the people. I am a Christian. I'm a Christian. I'm not a Church of Christ. The Holy Communion that's here. Sometimes we take words that are used in relationship to the Lord's Supper, and it is the communion. It is the Lord's Supper. But we develop a language of Ashdod, the concept of Ashdod, sometimes in relationship to that feast that's there. Language of Ashdod. I wish we had time to look at all of the remember passages that are found in this book. Six times, looked at the middle part of verse 22, "Remember me." Look down at verse 29. "Remember them, O my God, because they've defiled the priesthood." There's the problems that he had with these individuals who had disobeyed God. And this is an amazing way to end this book. "Remember me, O my God, for good." That's a pretty good way to end your life, isn't it? "Remember me, God, for good." And so in this book, he keeps saying, "Remember me, remember me, remember me, oh my God, remember me." Well, I've got about 10 after. I don't know what time you've got, but that's probably a good time to start winding all of this up and everything. We're finished with this. Be here next week. We're going to study the book of Esther. Same period of time. She's over in Persia, and a Jewish young lady becomes married to the most powerful person on earth, and that's the king of Persia. And if you don't know the story of Esther, if it's been a while since you've studied it, you're going to get excited as we study the book of Esther together. Thank you so much. You want to go ahead and ring that bell then? That'll be fine with me. You are dismissed.